Tonight on PBS News Weekend, a last-minute snag delays the release of hostages held by Hamas in exchange for Palestinians in Israeli prisons. Then how what we eat could be affecting our mental health. And a complicated history, the story of America's first and only Native American vice president.
It's very sad because I think society at that time forced him to choose. And he said it was at that moment I chose the white man's world. But he would be forever known as the Indian.
Good evening, I'm John Yang. Tonight, 13 more Israeli hostages held by Hamas and four foreign nationals have been freed after frantic negotiations resolved a last-minute snag. Hamas complains that Israel wasn't delivering all the aid to Gaza that it had promised, threatened not just this second round of hostage release, but the pause in fighting as well. Egyptian and Qatari officials were involved in resolving the problem, and that now clears the way for more happy reunions like yesterday's.
When Ohad Munder saw his father, no words were needed. They had been apart on Ohad's ninth birthday when he was being held by Hamas in Gaza. The family was reunited in Schneider Children's Medical Center in Petah Tikva. Ohad's mother and grandmother were also released. Missing from this scene, his grandfather, who's still being held captive. In another part of the hospital, four-year-old Raz Katz Asher in the arms of her father, telling him that over the last 50 days, she dreamt of going home. That dream has come true for her, her mother, and her younger sister. In Bethlehem on the West Bank, Hanan Takatka prepared a special breakfast for his son, Kasey, home after spending more than a year in an Israeli prison. He was among the Palestinian prisoners exchanged for Israeli hostages.
It's an indescribable feeling. Thank God I am with my family and with my mother and father. This means the world to me.
In Rafah, in southern Gaza, residents used the pause in fighting to line up for gas. In the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza, residents surveyed the damage from weeks of fighting.
What can I say? What do I tell you? Their homes are destroyed. Those who didn't have their homes destroyed lost their children.
But the peace is only temporary, Israeli Chief of Staff Herzi Halevi told his troops today to be ready to resume the fight. And in Tel Aviv, Israelis said that while they were happy some hostages had been released, the job won't be done until they're all home. Shahar Moore is related to the Munder family.
Each and every one here is a complete world in itself. You know, that there's so many people, there's so many life stories involved here.
Lives like Ohad Munder's, now able to reunite with both friends and family.
In Ukraine overnight, the most intense Russian drone attack of the war so far. Across Kyiv, sirens blared and the sky lit up with the five-hour assault. Ukrainian officials said air defenses knocked out 74 of the 75 Iranian-made drones that Russia deployed. At least five civilians were wounded, and buildings across the city were damaged by debris falling from the intercepted drones. And the Minnesota Attorney General said Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer convicted of murdering George Floyd, is expected to survive being stabbed by a fellow inmate at a federal prison in Arizona. Chauvin pressed a knee on Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes. The death spurred worldwide protest over police brutality and racism. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, the legacy of America's first Native American vice president, and a look at why doing good makes us feel good.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour. Weeknights on PBS.
The food we eat affects us in many ways. Eating a lot of highly processed foods has been shown to increase the risk of cancer, stroke, and heart disease. But what about mental health? Allie Rogan takes a deeper look at new research into that question.
A recent study from Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School finds a link between ultra-processed foods and depression. It found a nearly 50% increase in the risk of depression for those who consumed 9 portions or more of ultra-processed foods a day. Researchers also observed that foods and drinks containing artificial sweeteners could increase the incidence of depression. The study observed the eating habits and mental health status of more than 31,000 middle-aged, mostly white women for nearly 15 years. Olivia Okereke worked on the study and is an associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Olivia, thank you so much for joining us. Where did the idea to study this connection come from?
Well, depression, we know, is one of the leading causes of disability worldwide. There are hundreds of millions of people affected by depression, and so we need to identify ways to prevent it, to modify the risk. And diet is one of those things that people can readily modify. So we wanted to look at an important dietary factor, in this case, the frequency of consumption of processed foods. If we looked at all of these ultra-processed foods combined, that a higher number of servings of these, 9 or more compared to 4 or fewer per day, were related to this increased risk of depression. But there were certain types of processed foods that had a particularly high risk. So the artificially sweetened beverages in particular, we saw had an increased risk of depression.
Let's just break down really quick. What are the reasons why processed food is so bad for us?
So we know that processed foods involve adding artificial flavorings, preservatives, sweetening. They sometimes involve modification to the food itself, stripping it of some of its nutrient components. The other thing is that the chemicals involved in ultra-processing of foods also may be unhealthful. So we think that they may be triggering some unhealthy biological processes that are the same things that could be predisposing to depression.
And of course, there are a number of different risks when it comes to depression. There's family history. How are you able to rule out that participants in this study were not experiencing one of those other risk factors?
Well, there's a couple of things that we do. So the first is that we make sure that at the start of following up the participants, that they're not affected by depression already. So we're really looking into what we call incident depression. That means the person is developing depression during the follow-up. And then the second thing that we do is we look at a whole range of other factors that may correlate with diet. So things like smoking, physical activity, there's a whole range of these factors, and they're all very carefully measured in these same women.
Now, the cohort we're talking about, it's an existing observational study. It's called the Nurses' Health Study. And you make clear in the study the limitations of this cohort because it's primarily, as we said, middle-aged white women. What are the drawbacks of such a limited cohort?
Well, one of the strengths is that it's very large. These women have been followed for nearly 50 years. And so we know a lot about a whole range of factors. And that's critical for doing careful analyses. Of course, there aren't any men, and it may not be as diverse as we see in other cohorts. And so that is a limitation. And that means if there's a stronger association, for example, of these ultra-processed foods and depression risk among young people or among other groups in the population, we won't really be able to say anything about that.
And that really leads to my next question, which is how clear is the link between ultra-processed foods and mental health right now, and what sort of additional study needs to be conducted?
So one of the strengths of this particular study is that there really weren't prior studies of this type. So we've alerted people to this potential issue. And so some of the next steps are the following. The first is to look at a broader sample of people. So for example, other studies that have data on diet and on depression, but maybe more diverse in terms of age ranges, gender, racial or ethnic backgrounds. Another type of follow-up that can be done is to try to understand the mechanisms. For example, ultra-processed foods may increase inflammation in the body. They may cause metabolic changes in the body that are the same things that we suspect are related to risk of depression. But additional studies to probe those mechanisms can also be done.
Olivia Okereke with Harvard Medical School, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
When Kamala Harris became vice president, many said she was the first person of color in that position. But many Native Americans are quick to say she's actually the second. In 1929, Charles Curtis, an enrolled member of the Kaw Nation, became Herbert Hoover's vice president. Deb Goodrich is writing a biography of Curtis called From the Reservation to Washington, The Rise of Charles Curtis. And Ken Belmard is a tribal attorney, a member of the Kaw Nation, and a distant cousin of Charles Curtis. Thank you both for joining us. Deb, I'd like to start with you. I know you're writing a book about Charles Curtis, but can you give us sort of the thumbnail biography about how he was raised, where he grew up?
Charlie Curtis, and he did encourage Charlie, the familiar, was born on the north bank of the Kaw River, named for the Kaw Nation, just north of Topeka in 1860. Kansas would become a state a year later. There is no more divided, no more contentious place on earth at that moment than the Kansas-Missouri border in the midst of Bleeding Kansas and the Civil War, and then later the Plains Indian Wars. And he comes of age in all of these times of turmoil. His father is a pioneer. His mother is French Kaw. And he loses his mother, so is effectively an orphan at the age of three. She dies, and his dad goes off to join the Union Army. And he pretty much is raised by his grandmothers, his white grandmother in Topeka, and then his French Kaw grandmother on the reservation at Council Grove, Kansas. His French and Kaw grandmother is the one that tells Charlie to go back to Topeka to stay with his white family and get an education so he will amount to something. And he said later, everything he became, he owed to her. And it's very sad because I think society at that time forced him to choose. And he said, it was at that moment I chose the white man's world. But he would be forever known as the Indian.
Ken, given that fact, given that he grew up, really came of age in white culture, how was he viewed by members of the Kaw Nation?
The Kaw Nation takes a mixed view of Charles Curtis. I think those of us that are related to him, we appreciate the fact that he was a man of accomplishment. However, others in the tribe, because of the fact that the Curtis Act, which was very detrimental to tribal governments, bears his name, I think that causes a lot of people to have some mixed emotions about him and maybe not think of him in an overly positive way.
You mentioned the Curtis Act. That abolished tribal courts and put the residents of tribal lands under federal law. That was a big blow to tribal sovereignty.
Yeah, well, that's correct. I believe that Charles Curtis probably made a conscious thought that because of the pressures that were happening, that the only way for tribes and tribal people to succeed in any way was to assimilate.
Deb, given that he was a great advocate of assimilation, when he went into politics, and by the way, he wasn't just vice president, he was Senate Majority Leader at one point, he came close to winning the Republican presidential nomination at another point. Did he use his identity as a Native American in politics when he ran?
Other people used his identity. I think he was somebody who was very practical, and I think even with the Curtis Act, he truly saw this, and I believe he was sincere, that he was protecting those nations and his kinsmen. You know, John, Indians couldn't vote. They weren't citizens for, you know, most of Charlie's life. And for him, I think that was the most important thing. They had to be citizens. They had to be part of the government and making the government work. And that was their only way to survive. So I don't think he used it.
What do you think his political legacy is?
He was certainly a man of compromise. He built relationships with people on both sides of the aisle. He knew what every man wanted. He knew their wives, their kids, their dogs' names, and he truly went across the aisle to get things done. He was a champion of women's rights. He introduces the Equal Rights Amendment, and he didn't just mouth that. He practiced it. His half-sister is the second female secretary for a congressman to go to Washington. And he trusted her to speak for him on stage. And I do think that part of that understanding of women's rights and appreciation from it does come from that Kaw ancestry, where the women are so revered. And I definitely think that is one area where his Kaw heritage plays a part.
Ken, as we said, you are related to Charles Curtis. What did you hear growing up? Any stories from older relatives about Curtis?
One of my uncles, Mose Belmard, who was a World War I veteran, was a very good friend of Charles Curtis, and they actually campaigned together, with Mose being an advance man for him. So he was seen in at least in our family as someone that was to be looked up to and revered. But at the same time, you know, there was the understanding he was a man of his times, and he did what he believed was best for himself and for his family and for his political party.
Ken Belmard and Deb Goodrich, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Giving someone a hand with their car, a simple thank you to a cashier. These acts of kindness, whether big or small, can have a huge effect on others. Allie Rogan is back with a look at insights into the power of these acts of kindness.
If we've learned anything through this journey, it's coming together and taking on those little moments, appreciating the little things.
3 years ago, Lorelai Colbert was diagnosed with an aggressive form of breast cancer.
I was facing a very scary diagnosis at the age of 28, and it came out of nowhere. When you get a diagnosis like that, it shifts your perspective on a lot of things. And for me, it was just tapping into how do I want to live.
On her first day of chemo, she set a goal to channel her pain into purpose and inspire the community around her to do the same. So she turned to social media and encouraged her friends, family, and anyone else who wanted to join in to simply be kind to one another.
What I'm challenging everyone to do is please uplift me with acts of good.
She called it the Chemo to Kindness Challenge. Over 16 weeks of treatment, these individual acts became a movement.
We are at 1,127 acts of kindness around the world.
It could be anything from opening the door for a stranger. It could be calling your mom, calling your grandmother, making a donation to a nonprofit. We had some teachers do lessons on kindness in the elementary schools. And I had students helping their mothers, their brothers. They were dropping off cookies to neighbors.
Along the way, Colbert became more and more interested in the science behind these acts of kindness.
I learned that acts of kindness raise the oxytocin levels in you. So if you're performing an act of kindness, or you're paying it forward to someone else, it's science that your body is getting that wave of love, that wave of happiness.
UCLA scientist Naomi Eisenberger studies brain activity during an act of kindness.
What we found is that even in the height of COVID, 2 or 3 acts of kindness a week seem to significantly reduce levels of depression and anxiety.
One study Eisenberger worked on looked at acts of kindness between romantic partners.
When we look at what's going on neurally for the person who's providing this kind act, who's helping their partner, we see increased activation in certain reward-related regions. These are regions like the ventral striatum and the septal area. And so the idea here is that maybe there's something rewarding about actually being able to help a loved one.
It turns out that interacting with other people can often be a powerful source of happiness. So being kind to other people can improve our well-being.
Amit Kumar studies kindness and its impacts as part of his research at the University of Texas.
The main question that we were testing is whether these acts of kindness actually go even further than people anticipate. What was interesting to me as a happiness researcher is that people have lots and lots of opportunities for being kind to other people, doing things that are going to make them happy or that are likely to make them happy, that they don't always take advantage of.
Kumar's study found that receivers of acts of kindness felt better than expected, and the givers of kindness were happier than before the act.
What we find is that performers of an act of kindness are thinking about whatever it is they're giving. How much would someone like a cupcake, or how much would someone like a hot chocolate or an item like that from someone else as a random act of kindness tends to give the recipient something beyond the cupcake or the hot chocolate itself. It suggests that someone cares about them, that someone wanted them to feel good, that someone wanted them to feel happy.
The study also found that people consistently undervalued the impact of their kindness on others.
What people told us is that they wanted to perform more random acts of kindness in their lives. So if this is something that we want to be doing more often, if it's something that makes us feel better, why aren't we doing it? Well, one of the reasons is because we think it might not matter as much as it actually does.
Lorelei Colbert has been cancer-free for nearly 2 years, but the impact of her kindness challenge remains.
People feel better. You can make a big difference by doing one act of good. I think it has the power to save a life. And I think when we all take a little bit of accountability to say, if I do this one act of good, I can really impact others, it will make our world a much better place to be.
The phrase kindness is contagious might be a cliche, but it turns out it's also backed by science. For PBS News Weekend, I'm Allie Rogan.
And that is PBS News Weekend for this Saturday. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow.